content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the November 16th, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week is set on a golf course. Sitting in a golf cart are Donald Trump in the driver's seat and Nancy Pelosi in the passenger seat. President Trump is holding the steering wheel and he's got kind of a frown on his face. And Nancy Pelosi is smiling brightly and got her elbow back over the seat. And the title on the of the cover is Back in the Game. How will the Democrats' House majority use its power? And the election is our first main story. We'll start right there. Democrats reclaim House. GOP prevails in Senate. What happened? Voters rendered a mixed verdict on the Trump presidency this week as Democrats harnessed a suburban backlash to retake the House of Representatives, while Republicans expanded their Senate majority with victories in more rural, conservative-leaning states. After a bitterly fought campaign, an estimated 113 million Americans cast ballots, about 49% of the eligible voters, the highest midterm participation rate since 1966. Across the country, a diverse coalition of minorities, young people, and college-educated white voters in cities and suburbs rebuked the president by helping Democrats win their first House majority in 8 years. As the week went to press, Democrats had gained at least 27 seats, more than the 23 seats they needed to regain the chamber, with about a dozen races still too close to call. More than 100 Democratic women were swept into office, including the first two Native American and first two Muslim women to be elected to Congress. Progressive star Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York made history as the youngest woman ever elected to Congress at age 29. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, almost certain to become the next Speaker of the House, promised that the Democrats would use their share of power to provide a meaningful check on the Trump administration. Tomorrow, Pelosi said, will be a new day in America. Hopes for a Democratic wave ended in the Senate, however, where Democrats had to defend 10 seats in states that Trump won in 2016. Republicans are expected to increase their Senate majority from 51 to 53 seats once the final votes are tallied. Democratic incumbents Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, Joe Donnelly of Indiana, and Claire McCaskill of Missouri were all soundly defeated. West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin, the only member of his party to vote to confirm Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, held on to his seat in a very pro-Trump state. In Texas, Republican Ted Cruz survived a surprisingly strong challenge from Beto O'Rourke. President Trump, who held 11 campaign rallies over the past week, swiftly took credit for Senate Republican gains, saying, "I thought it was very close to complete victory." What the editorial said: "This election was a referendum on Trump, and he failed," said the Boston Globe. "The president was a millstone around the neck of Republicans across the country. Democrats flipped 29 GOP-held seats, scoring upset victories in red state suburbs near Charleston, South Carolina, Kansas City, Missouri, Dallas, and Oklahoma City. In terms of the overall national vote, it was one of the most lopsided midterms in recent history, favoring Democrats by roughly 7%. The loud and clear message from American voters is that they don't like the racially divisive and inflammatory leadership from the White House." Actually, Democrats fell devastatingly short of their own expectations, said WashingtonExaminer.com. Voters almost always punish the president's party during an administration's first midterm election, but this was hardly a wave. Democrats lost 63 House seats and their House majority under President Obama in 2010. In 1994, Democrats lost 54 seats under President Clinton, as well as their Senate majority. Under Trump, Republicans actually gained Senate seats, which means Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell will continue confirming Trump's conservative judicial appointees at a brisk pace. The resounding rebuke liberals hoped to deliver Trump has landed as a modest disagreement. What the columnist said, with unemployment at a mere 3.7% and the economy growing, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com, the Republicans' loss of the House is a profound political failure. The GOP also had other advantages, including partisan gerrymandering and the fact that so many Democratic voters are packed into a small number of urban congressional districts. Nevertheless, Americans decisively voted the GOP out of power in the House. Republicans are paying a Trump tax for supporting a demagogic and divisive president who hasn't breached 50% approval since taking office. If they can't win when conditions are perfect for them, what will happen if the economic tide turns? Voters clearly wanted a check on Trump, said Josh Krasher in NationalJournal.com, but they don't necessarily trust Democrats with full governing responsibility. Red State Democrats' attacks on Kavanaugh during his hearings helped transform many close contests into GOP blowouts. Vulnerable GOP incumbents also survived in many House districts where Democrats lurched too far left for voters' comfort. The Democrats who did well in the critical suburbs were moderates who reassured swing voters that they didn't support single-payer health insurance, open borders, and a wild-eyed foreign policy. A polarized nation is now more deeply divided, said Julie Pace in the Associated Press. President Trump's base, dominated by white men and rural voters, emphatically stuck by him. Women and minorities went strongly in the opposite direction, motivated by a deep opposition to Trump's nationalist agenda and racially charged rhetoric. Right now, neither coalition seems capable of making sizable inroads into each other's turf, said Ramesh Ponuru in Bloomberg.com, and neither is big enough to truly govern the country. What we can more realistically look forward to is two more years of social division, partisan rancor, and governmental sclerosis. Controversy of the week, also related to the election, the Democrats. How will they use their new power? Democrats are back, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com, and they're ready to take on Trump. While not producing the crushing repudiation of President Trump that liberals were hoping for, this week's midterm elections gave the Democratic Party control of the House of Representatives and the ability to tie him up in knots. It will be all but impossible for Democrats to enact any kind of progressive legislation, given the near certainty of Republican obstruction in the Senate and Trump's veto. But gaining the House gives Democrats the key chairmanships and subpoena power they need to conduct strict oversight of the Trump administration, a vital constitutional duty in which the current GOP-led House has showed absolutely no interest. Returning House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says impeachment is off the table, said David Korn in MotherJones.com. But come January, the White House will likely still be hit by a wave of investigations and subpoena requests, with no precedent in American history. The House will investigate Trump's hidden tax returns, payments the Trump Organization is receiving from foreign sources, his shady dealings with Russia, his shameful family separation policy, and much, much more. 2 years into an administration that has made so many Americans fear for the future of their democracy, it's finally Trump's turn to be afraid. A blizzard of investigations won't be enough for the far left, said Thomas Del Beccaro in WashingtonExaminer.com. Democrats will almost certainly try to impeach Trump. Despite Pelosi's qualms, the party's base and many of its wealthy donors will see anything less than a full-bore impeachment effort as cowardly capitulation to a president they truly loathe. Voters would hate the prolonged political chaos caused by impeachment, said David French in NationalReview.com, and would punish Democrats for it, just as they punished Republicans for impeaching President Clinton. But Democrats may not have much choice. If Special Counsel Robert Mueller produces strong evidence that Trump colluded with Russia or obstructed justice, it is difficult to imagine a Democratic House resisting progressive demands to try to remove the president from office. All in good time, said Ronald Klein in WashingtonPost.com. If Democrats want to make the most of this week's victory, not a single subpoena should fly in the first 100 days of the new Congress. Instead, they should draft and pass a series of pragmatic, common-sense bills on issues with widespread public support, strengthening the Affordable Care Act and lowering premiums, raising the federal minimum wage to $15, employing Americans to repair infrastructure such as roads and bridges, and granting the Dreamers legal status to protect them from deportation. Pass those, and then dare the Senate and the Trump White House to follow suit. The Democrats' strategy will largely depend on how Trump reacts to sharing power, said Andrew Prokop in Vox.com. He may decide that 2 years of all-out warfare with the Democratic House is exactly what he needs to keep his loyal followers fired up to reelect him in 2020. Or he might be tempted by the example of Bill Clinton, who won a second term by tacking to the center following his own midterm rebuke in 1994. Either way, the New York Times said the New York Times in an editorial, this upturn in Democrats' political fortunes comes with a heavy responsibility. With Republicans fully bullied into submission by Trump, it now falls to House Democrats alone to restore some sanity to American politics and a sense of higher common purpose to American governance. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for the wait staff, with reports that the Boston Red Sox left a $195,000 tip at a Los Angeles nightclub after celebrating last month's World Series victory. The team's bill came to $300,000 for about 170 bottles of champagne, vodka, and assorted spirits. It was a good week for dropping all pretense after Fox News hosts Sean Hannity and Jeanine Pirro went on stage and delivered campaign speeches at a rally for President Trump and Republicans this week in Missouri. Hannity, who had denied reports he'd go on stage, pointed to the press section and said, "All those people are fake news." And it was a good week for party loyalty after Nevada voters elected brothel owner Dennis Hoff to a state assembly seat, despite the fact that Hoff is dead. Hoff died last month after throwing himself a 72nd birthday party attended by porn star Ron Jeremy and former sheriff Joe Arpaio. But it was a bad week for vegetarians, who report lower self-respect and derive less pleasure from life than omnivores, a new study found. The primary problem, said researcher Dr. John Neslek, is that vegetarians may be excluded from social events or made to feel odd or different. And it was a bad week for, this is a tough one to pronounce, but I'm going to try. Esanbehanakitakojima, a tiny uninhabited island off the coast of Japan, which seems to have disappeared. The island is a recognized landmark of Japan's border with neighboring Russia, but may have been eroded by wind and weather and sunk beneath rising seas. And finally, it was a bad week for taking your coffee black after a new study found that people who shun milk and sugar in their Java are more likely to be psychopaths. Researchers found a robust relation between increased enjoyment of bitter foods and a heightened sadistic proclivities. Well, let's move on. Here's a boring but important item still on this page. A ban on sexual health. The State Department is considering a proposal that would bar U.S. diplomats from using the terms sexual and reproductive health and comprehensive sexual education, reported Politico.com. Those terms have been used for years in domestic and international government communications, but would be replaced under this proposal by phrases such as reproduction and the related health services. Several social conservatives at state and other agencies are reportedly pushing the change. The ban could impair relations with the UN and complicate funding requests from groups focused on women's reproductive rights. The State Department has already removed mentions of access to contraception and abortion from human rights reports. Our briefing page article this week is titled, How Saudi Arabia Became an Ally. The killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi has threatened the U.S.'s longstanding ties to Saudi Arabia. When did the alliance start? The relationship goes back to the late 1930s, just after Abdul Aziz ibn Saud consolidated squabbling Arab tribes into a kingdom. U.S. energy companies had discovered oil in the Arabian Peninsula, and they asked their government to promote their interest with the new monarch. In 1945, President Franklin Roosevelt met King Abdul Aziz aboard a U.S. ship in the Suez Canal, and the two got along famously. FDR gave the ailing king one of his own wheelchairs, which the king later called his most precious possession. FDR succeeded in ensuring that the U.S., and not the British, would control Saudi oil. In return, the U.S. would provide security for the kingdom. Within a few years, a U.S. military base was set up near the oil fields. Over the decades, the oil for security arrangement has become vital to both countries. Saudi Arabia is now the U.S. defense industry's largest foreign customer, buying some $112 billion worth of weapons during the Obama administration alone. Has the alliance ever wavered? The 1973 oil embargo was a major rough patch. For a year, the Saudis quit selling to the U.S. in retaliation for U.S. support of Israel in the Yom Kippur War. But the two countries made up, united in opposition to the Soviet Union. Even the 9/11 attacks couldn't loosen the bond. Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and 15 of the 19 hijackers who flew planes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon were Saudi nationals. And U.S. public opinion turned strongly against the kingdom after Saudi citizens were allowed to leave the U.S. right after the attack. before the FBI could interview them. But President George W. Bush, whose family had long-standing Saudi business relationships, stood by the alliance, and in 2005, he was photographed holding hands with then-Crown Prince Abdullah. In the decade after 9/11, the Saudis spent more than $100 million on public relations in the U.S., trying to overcome the country's image as an exporter of terrorism. Is that image true? Yes. Decades ago, the Saudi monarchy made a tacit bargain with radical Islamists in the country. It would fund the spread of Wahhabism, the Saudi form of ultra-conservative Islam, and jihadism around the world, as long as the radicals didn't blow up targets inside Saudi Arabia. Saudi money funded Islamist militants in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bosnia, and the Russian province of Chechnya. After 9/11, Saudi officials claimed to have turned off the money spigot. But secret U.S. diplomatic cables published by WikiLeaks in 2009 said Saudi Arabia remains a critical financial support base for al-Qaeda, the Taliban, the Pakistani terrorist group Lashkar-e-Taiba, and the Palestinian terrorist group Hamas, giving them millions of dollars annually. What about human rights? With its draconian form of Sharia law, Saudi Arabia's autocratic government is consistently rated among the worst of the worst human rights offenders. Its gender apartheid system treats women as second-class citizens, shrouded in abayas, dependent on male guardians, and mostly barred from going out alone and from any form of public life. There's no freedom of religion, and the press is censored. Brutal public floggings and stonings are the penalty for such crimes as adultery and apostasy. Those arrested are routinely tortured to extract confessions. Last year, Saudi Arabia put to death 146 people for crimes including murder and drug dealing. Most of the executions were beheadings. What's in it for the U.S.? Saudi oil, of course, although last year it made up only 9% of what the U.S. used because of our fracking revolution. More strategically important today is the Saudis' regional role in counterbalancing Iran. Ever since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, when Iranian mullahs took U.S. diplomats hostage, the U.S. has seen Iran as the most dangerous actor in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia, which practices Sunni Islam, opposes the Iranian Shiite theocracy's proxy interventions in other Middle Eastern countries, including Syria, Lebanon, and Yemen. More recently, the Saudis have begun working with America's other major regional ally, Israel, because both countries see Iran as an existential threat. How has Trump affected the relationship? The president has long-standing business ties with the Saudis. By his own account, he sold them millions of dollars worth of real estate. "Am I supposed to dislike them?" he said while campaigning for president. "I like them very much." Since taking office, he has made the Saudi alliance a priority. His first foreign trip was to Riyadh. Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, quickly grew close to one of the king's sons, Mohammed bin Salman, and the administration strongly supported Mohammed's elevation to crown prince last year, viewing him as a reformer intent on modernizing his country. Congress, though, is not so enamored. The killing of Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul last month prompted the Senate to invoke the Global Magnitsky Human Rights Accountability Act, which requires the president to identify within 4 months which individual Saudis should be sanctioned. "In moments like this, you have to embrace your values," said Senator Lindsey Graham. "No more transactional interactions." And we'll move into some of the best columns of the week. The first, titled, Who Really Lost This Election? Do you know who lost the midterm elections? Asked Robert Samuelson. We all did. Both parties made the midterms a referendum on President Trump at the expense of anything resembling rational debate on the serious, politically explosive problems facing the country. Take the federal deficit, which ballooned to $782 billion this year and is projected to hit $1 trillion in 2019. Why so much red ink? Simple. Americans want more government benefits and services than they're willing to pay for in taxes. Rather than address our profligacy, Democrats are talking of a wildly expensive expansion of benefits while Trump is promising more tax cuts. The debate over immigration has been reduced to a simplistic choice between the wall and open borders, when it's clear comprehensive reform is necessary. In this election, there was virtually no realistic engagement with climate change, despite it being the great moral issue of our time. To address any of these issues, political leaders must be willing to compromise and accept short-term costs for long-term gains. Unfortunately, politicians want to win, so they tell voters what they want to hear. So on we stumble, blind to the dangers ahead. This comes from Sweden, longing to be a submissive housewife. There are few clearer signs of the conservative winds blowing through Europe, said Jonna Sima, than the anti-feminist sentiments now being peddled by young Swedish women. Greta Thurfjell, a 24-year-old journalist, created a stir with a recent newspaper article in which she pushed an unapologetically traditional view of a woman's role. She explained how she wants nothing more than to be a submissive housewife, devoted to making her man happy. For millennial women raised in a culture of liberalism and political correctness, she says, conservatism's forbidden status makes it new and exciting. Feminists, Thurfjell adds, are not cool. Having walked into a well-paid, secure job at a culture magazine straight out of college, she clearly has no idea how hard women had to struggle to achieve the freedoms she takes for granted. Thurfjell has bought into the retrogressive ideology peddled by Steve Bannon, U.S. President Donald Trump's former White House strategist, who has been traveling through Europe, firing up the far right, and calling the women's rights movement the biggest threat to the patriarchal social order. Right-wingers in Sweden are now mobilizing against abortion rights and moaning that feminism has gone too far. Women like Thurfjell may get a thrill flirting with these ideas, but they probably wouldn't like the long-term consequences. And from South Korea, our future as a mixed society. Koreans are going to have to get over their ethno-nationalism and embrace immigration, said Lee Soo-yoon. Our country's birth rate is projected to sink below one child per woman this year, and South Korea's workforce is aging faster than any other advanced economies. The government's focus has been on encouraging Korean women to have more babies, but that's not going to cut it. Despite the 10% youth unemployment rate, factories and construction sites already face shortages of workers because young Koreans refuse to do dirty and dangerous jobs. Instead, that work is done by 280,000 mostly Southeast Asian migrants here on temporary visas. As our population gets grayer, we will need more willing foreign workers. We can attract them by allowing immigrants to become Korean citizens, which will mean transitioning to a multiracial society. It's a tall order since Koreans are taught from an early age to be proud of their Korean bloodline and conditioned into cultural homogeneity. Sociologists say that could change if the truth about Korea's past were made more widely known. Some 500 years ago, for example, nearly 10% of the population was foreign, and their genes are part of what is now Korean. Our transition to a multiracial society is inevitable. We might as well embrace it. Time for the last word, our longer article, this week titled, The Invasive Reptiles Taking Over Florida. Brought in as pets, the Burmese python and the Nile monitor lizard are eating their way through Florida's endangered species, said Chris Sweeney in Audubon. Now more exotic reptiles may join them. It's a sweaty June morning on the outskirts of Tampa, and droves of reptile enthusiasts are streaming into an air-conditioned expo center. Some have woken early to trek out to the Florida State Fairgrounds to get first crack at the animals of Repticon, a week-long extravaganza that's similar to a baseball card convention, except instead of mint-conditioned Mickey Mantles and Pete Roses, there are green anacondas and meat-eating lizards. A guy strolls by wearing a Snakes Lives Matter t-shirt. Another man, who has a 3-foot-long lizard slung across his chest like a bandolier, is at a nearby booth admiring a young boa constrictor that's twirling around his girlfriend's fingers. Price? $100. Sold. Roughly 60 Repticons take place each year from Phoenix to Oklahoma City to Baltimore, attracting an estimated 200,000 visitors. These shows represent but a tiny sliver of the live reptile trade. In much of the continental United States, these cold-blooded creatures aren't likely to fare well outdoors should they escape or be set free. But the subtropics of South Florida are different. And the best adapted have not only survived in the wild, but they have thrived. To date, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, or FWC, has identified 50 types of non-native lizards, turtles, crocodilians, and snakes within state limits, more than anywhere else in the world. For the birds of Florida, this blitz of exotic predators poses an existential-scale threat. The Burmese pythons, which stalk wading birds in the Everglades, have become so menacing that the state has hosted derby-style competitions to catch them. Farther north, Nile monitors, the largest lizards in Africa, have been terrorizing a population of burrowing owls in the city of Cape Coral. And on the outskirts of Florida City, just outside Everglades National Park, egg-eating Argentine tegus could soon raid the nesting grounds of one of the last remaining populations of the endangered Cape Sable seaside sparrow. Each of these reptiles found its way to Florida via the pet trade. But while most people acknowledge that's a leaky pipeline, few agree on whether and how to plug it. Take Ed Poelsma, who's wandering Repticon with Pugsley, a 5.5-foot-long black-throated monitor that's a close relative of the Komodo dragon. Pugsley is a stunning creature that looks to be from prehistoric times, with claws like steak knives, camouflage skin, and a muscular tail. What does Pugsley eat? Meat, Poelsma says. He would eat anything you put in his cage that's meat. Literally anything. You don't need a permit to buy a Pugsley of your own, and that's how Poelsma thinks it should be. It's a sentiment that almost everyone I meet at Repticon echoes, including Greg Graziani, who has starred on National Geographic's The Python Hunters and now runs a reptile breeding facility. The bird people are worried, he says. I understand their concern, but I haven't seen the science. Truth is, scientists have never seen anything quite like this. It's the Monday morning after Repticon, and I'm in a vacant lot in Cape Coral watching Bob Mongok smack a package of frozen chicken with the claw end of a hammer. He pries free a hunk of raw poultry and tosses it to the back of a spring-plated trap in hopes of luring in one of the invasive Nile monitors that haunt this Gulf Coast city. Mongok works for the Cape Coral Environmental Resources Division, a six-person unit that could easily have been the inspiration for Parks and Recreation. Over the years, he has tangled with more monitors than he can remember. Nile monitors have no business in this hemisphere. As their name implies, they should be basking along the shores of Africa's Nile Delta. But they got popular in the pet trade, and rumor has it that the owner of a now-defunct pet store, scheming a source of free inventory, let some loose behind his shop so they would breed in the wild. These reptiles can top 7 feet, swim like Michael Phelps, and eat rodents, birds, rabbits, wasp nests, venomous rattlesnakes, poisonous cane toads, and according to some residents, cats and dogs. There's no telling how many Nile monitors are out there. Since 2000, the city has logged more than 2,500 sightings and trapped 564 of the animals. Over all those years, though, no one has uncovered a monitor nest, an unsettling tidbit given that the lizards can lay up to 60 eggs at a time. Conservative estimates put their population at 1,000, a lowball number in Mongok's eyes, because many residents are so accustomed to the animals that they don't bother calling one in. Today, Mongok will bait 11 traps, all within view of nice homes with pools, screened-in porches, and garages. As we drive from site to site, we pass a handful of dusty lots where burrowing owls perch on wooden stakes and look like adorable stuffed animals. That the city is home to one of the world's largest populations of burrowing owls is a point of pride among some residents, not to mention a good tourism draw. The owls are staring down a long list of threats, including significant habitat loss, and FWC declared them a threatened species in November 2016. It's known that Nile monitors eat burrowing owls. After all, the lizards are expert burrowers and ground hunters. What's unknown is the number of owls they have devoured. One of the first confirmed cases dates to May 2005, when a woman saw a large monitor in her yard with a tawny in its jaws. Unfazed, she grabbed a flower pot and threw it at the lizard. It dropped the owl and bolted away, but the bird did not survive. At least two other instances of monitors eating owls have been reported, and it seems certain that other attacks have gone unseen and undocumented. Back at Repticon, I saw at least 5 different types of monitors for sale. It's a family of lizards that has roughly 70 species, and only 2, the Komodo dragon and the Nile monitor, are now tightly regulated here. FWC classifies the Nile monitor as a conditional species, along with only 7 other reptiles, including the Burmese python and reticulated python, at nearly 30 feet, one of the largest snakes in the world. These species can't be sold as pets, but with the right permits, you can have them for commercial, research, and exhibition purpose. Dozens of other monitor species, crocodile monitors, Argus monitors, tree monitors, can be brought in and sold. No problem. 2 days after we part ways, one of the 11 traps we set nabs a 3-foot Nile monitor that was first spotted climbing a resident's front door. Like nearly all the monitors Mongok traps, it was placed into a sealed plastic tube and exposed to a lethal dose of chloroform. Death by asphyxiation, a grisly fate. But what other options are there? Biological invasions aren't necessarily blitzkriegs. It doesn't matter if a pet store releases a few dozen lizards, or a hurricane damages a breeding facility and sets free hundreds of snakes, as has happened. Some of the invaders die off, scooped up by predators or unable to adjust to their new environs. Others find food, find a mate, and survive. With each new egg that's fertilized and each animal that reaches sexual maturity, the monetary and ecological costs of the problem go up. Biologists call this the invasion curve, and right now Nile monitors fall somewhere in the middle. Any hope of eradicating them in Florida faded long ago, but it may be possible to keep them contained to a few small pockets around the state. One is Cape Coral, another is in Palm Beach County, site of President Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort. Keep following the invasion curve upward, past the point of containment, past the Nile monitor, all the way to the top, and you will find the Burmese python. This apex predator can grow to more than 18 feet long and was for a long time one of the most popular snakes in the pet trade. Now there are estimated tens or hundreds of thousands of Burmese pythons in South Florida, and they're eating everything. Rabbits, rats, bobcats, deer, even alligators. On the invasion curve, they fall in the resource protection and long-term management section. In other words, they're taking over, and our only hope is to safeguard what they have not yet destroyed. In 2012, a team of researchers reported in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that marsh rabbits, raccoons, and possums had all but vanished from sight in Everglades National Park. One of the culprits, they suggested, was the arrival of the Burmese python, which records show was established in the park around 2000. If that's the case, it took the snakes just a decade to eat their way through that section of the ecological menu. Now they may have shifted to wading birds for their next course. Those include the federally threatened wood stork, magnificent frigate bird, great blue heron, little blue heron, red-whiskered bulbul, snowy egret, and pie-billed grebe. To date, at least 39 different bird species have been found in the bellies of Florida's pythons. Nile monitors and Burmese pythons are similar in that they came, they destroyed, and they got regulated. They are cautionary tales, but legislators have been slow to heed the warnings. Case in point, the Argentine tegu, a squat lizard with a taste for eggs that isn't hard to find on the outskirts of Miami. To get a glimpse of these beasts, I'm in the back seat of a white Ford F-150, sitting next to a large plastic container labeled Dangerous Reptiles. At the wheel is Brittany Mason, and riding shotgun is Sarah Cook. They are trapping Argentine tegus on behalf of the University of Florida's CrocDocs lab. The truck lurches along dirt service roads in southern Miami-Dade County, stopping every few minutes so the women can check one of the 150 different traps that are nestled in the bushes. Tegus are bizarre-looking lizards with enormous jaw muscles that resemble jowls. They are omnivorous eating machines that have, in the past decade, rocketed up the invasion curve and are now so ubiquitous in this stretch of Florida that some grad students refer to it as Tegulandia. There are even tales of a local fast food joint that became renowned for tegus that burrowed under the drive-thru box and scared the hell out of unsuspecting customers. In their native South America, tegus have a fondness for eggs. They raid caiman nests and eat tinamou, a ground-dwelling bird. But as I'm learning today, they seem equally enticed by store-bought chicken eggs. An hour into the trip, Cook walks down a pile of rocks holding the first trapped tegu of the day, a juvenile that's 16 inches long, give or take. She shakes the lizard into a canvas bag, tags it with a pink piece of tape, and tosses it into the dangerous reptiles bin. About an hour later, the team bags a second and then a third, taken on the grounds of a firing range. The lizards have already raided alligator and turtle nests in Florida, and the area where we bagged six is mere miles from one of the last populations of the Cape Sable Seaside Sparrow, an endangered species that builds nests inches off the ground. Since 2014, the Croc Docs team has trapped 1,418 tegus. Yet for all the trouble they are causing and all the risks they pose, tegu sales aren't regulated in Florida. Unlike the Nile monitor and Burmese python, FWC does not classify tegus as a conditional species. Head to a Repticon, drive to a pet shop, or jump on Google and you can buy one for a few hundred bucks. Just like Burmese pythons and Nile monitors, tegus got a toehold in South Florida through the pet trade, where they are beloved as docile, intelligent, and affectionate companions. The fight against them is now at an inflection point. We're out of the eradication part of the invasion curve, and we're heading up through containment, said University of Florida Professor Frank Mazzotti, who leads the Croc Docs lab. The question is, are our efforts going to be enough? This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Audubon magazine. We'll get a couple of the health and science articles this week. First, crows show off a new trick. New Caledonian crows, whose problem-solving skills have long set them apart from other avians, can even assemble tools out of available parts, a new study has found. Native to the South Pacific island, after which they are named, the birds became famous for their cognitive abilities in 2002, when a captive crow gained access to a treat by creating a hook from a wire. In the new study, eight crows were presented with an assortment of different length cylinders. Individually, these sticks were too small to reach food that had been hidden in a box. But four of the birds realized within 5 minutes how to put two rods together, creating a pole that let them push the treat out of an opening in the container's side. One bird even constructed a four-rod pole, the first time an animal has been recorded making a tool with more than two components. The finding is remarkable because the crows received no assistance or training in making these combinations. Author August von Bayern from the Max Planck Institute of Ornithology in Schweitzen, Germany, tells ScienceDaily.com, they figured it out by themselves. And the health scare of the week, phthalates and language delays. Prenatal exposure to a type of chemical found in floor tiles, food packaging, shampoos, and cosmetics could cause language delays in young children, new research suggests. Scientists have long been concerned that phthalates, which make plastics more flexible and long-lasting, can affect the development of children's brains. The new study, a collaboration between teams in Sweden and the U.S., looks specifically at their impact on early speech development, reports the Philadelphia Inquirer. Researchers tested urine samples from about 1,365 pregnant women, all in their first trimester, for phthalates. When the women's children were between 30 and 37 months old, the researchers asked the mothers how many words their offspring used. They found that the children of women who had higher phthalate levels during pregnancy were more likely to suffer from a language delay, knowing fewer than 50 words. One of the study's authors, Shanna Swan from the Icahn School of Medicine in New York, advises pregnant women to try to reduce their exposure to phthalates by using scent-free personal care products and phthalate-free nail polish. But she acknowledges that chemicals are hard to avoid because they are hidden in many household products, like vinyl floor covering and upholstery. Mm-hmm. And here's an article from the Talking Points page. Yemen, the blood on U.S. hands. America is complicit in a humanitarian disaster of horrific proportions in Yemen, said the Los Angeles Times in an editorial. The 3.5-year long proxy conflict there between Saudi Arabia-backed government forces and Iran-allied Houthi rebels has left 17,000 civilians killed and injured. In a nation whose civil order has been shattered and where food has become unaffordable, millions more have left homeless, have been left homeless and beset by disease and starvation. A cholera epidemic has infected 1 million plus people. Horrific photos of starving children have prompted a public outcry. The U.S. has played a major role in this atrocity by refueling the warplanes of its Saudi ally and providing bombs, weapons, and intelligence to its forces. Last week, the Trump administration finally called for a ceasefire by the end of November, but it is unlikely to have much impact unless the U.S. makes clear to the Saudis that it is prepared to end its support. Why wait to end U.S. involvement in Yemen, said Daniel DePetris in WashingtonExaminer.com. The U.S. doesn't have any core security interest in Yemen other than suppressing terror groups such as Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP. If anything, U.S. involvement there has given AQAP a new lease on life as it steps up its recruitment among alienated Yemenis. Sadly, there is little reason to believe the Trump administration will insist on a ceasefire, said Jonah Shepp in NYMag.com. The administration was indifferent to Yemen's suffering until it faced mounting rage over the photos of starving Yemeni kids and Saudi Arabia's grisly murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Don't be surprised if the White House claims that the Saudis tried to make peace, but that Iranians and Houthis wouldn't cooperate. To end this brutal war, said Mohammed Elamchawi in AlJazeera.com, Trump would have to sever his personal ties with Saudi Arabia's de facto leader, Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS. Since President Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, gave their blanket endorsement to the aggressive young crown prince, MBS has engaged in ever more reckless behavior. The escalation of the Yemen war, his ruthless consolidation of power, and the Khashoggi murder. That murder has given the Trump administration an opportunity to correct its course and inform the Saudis we no longer support MBS. Only then does the U.S. have a real chance to end this morally bankrupt war. Iran sanctions. Is this maximum pressure? President Trump launched his campaign of maximum pressure on Iran this week, said Ellen Wald in Bloomberg.com, but it had a surprising loophole. Trump withdrew the U.S. from participation in an Obama-era nuclear accord with Iran in May and promised to force Iran into renegotiating that deal with new economic sanctions barring other countries from trading with Iran or buying its oil. When the U.S. reimposed sanctions this week, it exempted 8 countries, including Iran's 6 biggest oil customers. Why? It will keep more Iranian oil on world markets than expected, protecting American consumers from a sudden rise in gas and oil prices. Trump's hardliners are digging in for a long, cold war with Iran, said Michael Gordon in the Wall Street Journal. They believe that by barring Iran from the world banking system and reducing its exports, the U.S. will badly weaken the already shaky Iranian economy, forcing Tehran to pull back on its financial support for its proxy groups in Syria, Yemen, and Iraq. Iran, meanwhile, hopes to ride out the sanctions in hope that Trump is a one-term president. This is maximum pressure, asked Philip Klein in WashingtonExaminer.com. Trump said the U.S. was done making empty threats, yet the oil sanctions exemptions will allow billions to continue to flow into the mullah's coffers. The administration also stopped short of completely cutting Iran off from the international banking system, saying certain Iranian financial institutions could still use it for humanitarian reasons. If Trump is going to cushion the blow of sanctions, then what was the point of ditching Obama's deal? Trump fears the political consequences of a true hardball strategy, said Nick Cunningham in foreignpolicy.com. Oil prices are up about 10% since Trump nixed the nuclear deal and took about 800,000 barrels of Iranian oil off the market. American motorists are paying more at the pump, about $2.80 nationally, than at almost any time in the past 4 years. That's causing the administration to squirm. Trump's strategy had another huge flaw, said Josh Rogan in WashingtonPost.com. Squeezing Iran's economy requires cooperation from other countries. Yet China is still buying Iranian oil and has no intention of stopping. This gives Chinese President Xi Jinping another weapon in his ongoing strategic battle with the White House. Iran, meanwhile, gets some of the money it needs to wait out the Trump administration. And here's one short, interesting note. Over the past 20 years, there have been more than a dozen local and state elections in the United States that were either decided by a single vote or ended in a tie. And finally, we'll finish with a quote. The thing that makes you exceptional, if you are at all, is inevitably that which must also make you lonely. That's from playwright Lorraine Hansberry. And with that, we're out of time for today's episode of the week. Hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.